their rights, sovereignty, self-determination, implementation of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People in there, because the work's already been done for us. And so I just see this as a wonderful era where, you know, the old guard from the Northern Territory, Cape York, you know, the mad marciers who give these weird views that are unrepresentative of the aspirations of Aboriginal people, are in their death throes. I mean, they're not going to last much longer because, you know, no one's really listening to them and people are getting tired of their voices. So here's an opportunity now for us to fill that void. And what we've got to do, I think, which is the message I keep pumping, is start talking now about the practical effect of Aboriginal sovereignty. My final word on it is, I remember Jeff Clark saying in 1992, so about 21 years ago, if you want sovereignty, you've got to act sovereignty. And what he was talking about was, don't wait for someone to hand it over to us. Take it and use it in your daily lives and express it and mean it. And that way, you know, it puts pressure on the Australian government. Neil Ard or this other fellow with the big ears or anybody else. When they're talking about trying to control the Aboriginal people, what they're talking about is controlling Aboriginal sovereignty. And the one thing they fear, not sort of native title, because that's all pretty well stitched up. But what they do fear is Aboriginal people advocating sovereignty. And if that's their one fear, that's what we've got to do.
Hello.
Yes,
you there?
Yeah,
I'm here.
Any questions? Hey Michael, it's Phil Windsor here. I used to live down in Tasman in Launceston for a while and used to come along to meetings with yourself and other people at the TAC in Launceston.
And, I won't hold that against you, Phil.
one thing I noticed coming up to Queensland, back up to the mainland, was that the community in Tasmania is far more behind the sovereignty movement and far more, like, there's a lot more people interested in expressing their sovereignty, and, you know, a lot more people come along to meetings and those sort of things that you have, and they're getting there and getting involved in decision making, and, you know, they're out there living their culture to the most extent possible. And then you come to the mainland, there's a lot of people that just don't care, and they're not interested, it's not a priority for them. What's been the secret down there to having such a large number of people? Is it because of the amount of oppression that people in Tasmania suffered for so long that now, you know, they see this as a chance to fight back? Or is it because of the strategies that you've taken, like the activism strategies and those sorts of things, that more people are interested in being active?
Yeah, I'm not sure, Bill. I know I've heard that comment from other people on the mainland too about, you know, oh gee, if only we on the mainland had, but you know, I see the frustrations that you're talking about. You know, that many Aboriginal people in Tasmania who are happy to get a job, a good house, and who won't come to the meetings, and, you know, when they talk about they're all these cultural Aboriginal people, yet there's only a couple of hundred people who do these things. So I suppose it's all a matter of perspective. I think one of the advantages that we've got is that the Tasmania Aboriginal Centre runs the legal service, the health service, and a range of other programs, and it has always made sure that its facilities and its equipment buildings were available for Aboriginal community. A security card to get in, and they so I think it is a matter of changing the parties where all that nations around the country more or less the view. these
hold on, bear with us, we're trying to fix this cord. Sound. Keith talked about Mark Murdoch for a second.
No, we still got the link there?
Yeah, we're right now.
Yeah, what I was saying, Phil, is that like what you fellas are doing in Brisbane there is almost taking us back to the late 1960s and early 1970s, where before the money was around, people got together in the, sort of a grassroots movement, and from something positive had to come, and those organisations in the 70s and 80s evolved out of the sort of thing we're doing here now. So I wouldn't be too pessimistic about it. I think we're on the right track, and we've just got to be patient and keep working at it. See, the Olympic Games is another opportunity too. Like, why shouldn't we have an Aboriginal Olympic Games team instead of having to run in the green and gold colours? And just think, it wouldn't matter if we entered someone who'd come last in the marathon, because that person would get more publicity than the one who won it, especially with Bob Weatherall running in a bloody loincloth. When is that? Well, I've been away to Muttonbird Island, so you don't hear anything from anybody. So when's the
G20? That's next year.
Next
in
year.
In Brisbane, I think. Yeah,
yeah, next November. Yeah.
Good to me.
What we're talking about, Michael, is...
You can't hear
him. Yeah, I can hear him.
Yeah, what we're talking about is similar to what we had in 82, but you weren't here in 82, but they're having a committee again, a national working committee, a G20 working committee. There's a lot that we've got to do on that G20 stuff. We've got about 12 months lead time. It's irony how it's turned up in Brisbane again, just down the road from Musgrave Park. You know, the irony's between what happened back in 82 and what could happen next year with the G20. We've got a big responsibility. We've got a global responsibility. I guess to a lot of the other Indigenous people, we've got the West Papuan exercise that's going on up here. We've got other people that's still getting mucked over. So we've got a lot of international people that looking towards us for direction and participation in the G20 protest, and using that as a political lever to highlight their cases again. So one of the things we're trying to look at here is trying to get some sort of national working group again, trying to get back to that, trying to manage and strategize and work out how as a community, as a national community, and as a Brisbane community, of how we can approach this. Barack Obama, he reckons he's from Brisbane now, they reckon they've got all these posters around Europe. So how we get him, and how we get all these other fellas to talk about this. So it's something, you know, maybe people like yourself and Bob Weatherall and other people have a lot of lead time. How we attack that again, and it's something to focus on.
About the G20 or any other international event in Australia. Remember before the apartheid period was put that in, the movement to end apartheid was really centred around getting the world to isolate South Africa from international events. Sport, cricket, rugby, the cultural events they weren't allowed to participate in, and so on. And you see the greenies down here in Tasmania, the logging protests, even though they've got a forestry agreement. Yeah. lot from Texmark to the sea. They look to the turn for pressure. So it's almost a case of vitalising the profit and learning from these tactics of the greenies. We could mount a campaign is because of the way Australia treats Aboriginal people, Australia is not entitled back. And you could look, we could get a lot of white people who would support that sort of a campaign, and it would give us the chance to tell not only the national group in Australia, but also the world, what's happening in this country. And it would sort of spark a reaction from the Australian government, because at the moment there's no pressure on the Australian government not to hold themselves out with this great image that they are one of the great countries of the world and should be able to hold these international events, because, you know, they're very credible in the eyes of the international community. Now, we need to be able to start strategies, as Coco was saying, and start change that image by giving the information out.
Any other questions?
Any more questions before?
Oh, as you were saying before about how the TAC has control over, was the land council, the health clinics and all that down there?
Yeah.
When I was over in NZ a couple of weeks ago, one of the things I noticed is that there was these central tribal hubs, so for each of the Maori tribes, there would be the central administration that controls the health clinics, the language, the education, the radio, and all that sort of stuff. Do you think that's something that needs to be implemented more widely?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that the public servants in ATSIC who were running at the behest of the Australian government under first Keating and then Howard, rather than their Aboriginal masters, deliberately wanted to isolate Aboriginal people from the administration of these Aboriginal organisations. And I know in Tasmania we had that fight in the 90s, the same as other organisations did. And we used all of our resources and skills to take ATSIC to court. We had the media there ready to pounce on the ATSIC officials when they come down to shut us down and so on. Whereas on the mainland, people, I think, the organisations anyway, in trying to save their own neck, went along with them. And as a result of that, you've now lost control of any community control of those organisations. I think the consequence for us is that instead of Aboriginal people identifying with themselves as a community and the organisations being an outlet for their voice, instead you've got the organisations who are a power unto themselves and are beholden to the Australian government for funding, and the Aboriginal community sits way over here somewhere. And I think that's a tragedy. I think the Tasmanian situation is closer to New Zealand, where even though we get a hell of a lot of arguments internally within the TAC about the different needs of different people in the community and so on, those arguments are held within the sort of representative body of the organ of the community, rather than health service, legal service, family support, children's programs, all arguing publicly against each other. So I don't know what we can do about that. I think that if you could somehow engage with the organisations and bring them across, then that's a hope. But in the alternative, let's just go around them. If they're not part of the solution, they're just part of the problem.
Questions, because we're going to break off into a quick lunch break, and then after that, Money Man Graham's going to give a talk as well. And,
can you relay that to Michael as well?
To do with
the next part of the agenda.
After lunch we got Barry Graham talking.
Yeah, he'll be watching.
Yeah, he'll be watching. Have you got the live stream there?
It's up like 100 people now.
Yeah, I can see. Yeah.
Oh, people are actually watching the live stream?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's not really the way.
Miriam will be down there in a couple weeks as well.
Oh, yeah, and also we just had Miriam McKay from WA on Skype just before, and she said she'll be down in Tasmania and wants to have a chat to you.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, someone wants to talk to me.
Alright then, that's all the questions.
Come have some lunch.
Yep.
Yeah.
Have some
Goanna.
Not
Muttonbird. No
Muttonbird. I said, hey, to Witherall, why didn't he bring him in?
Wait,
what'd
you say?
I said, two boxes of Muttonbirds up for this conference to Bobby Witherall. He was going to bring him in and cook them.
Yeah.
All right, he's left them at home, he bloody misses, I suppose.
Alright then, well thank you very much for your time, and I hope you'll enjoy the rest of the conference.
Okay, guys. Tomorrow.
Yeah, and also tomorrow, will you be able to Skype in tomorrow?
Yes, I will. Yeah.
Okay, awesome, we'll be doing some workshops on that.
Okay then.
Talk to you tomorrow then.
Yeah.